All right, good morning, everyone. It's getting to the middle of the week. We've got to stay alive, alert. Okay, we got quite a few things still to get through to finish our thoughts on Daniel. Brother Darrell, I think, provided me a pretty good introduction this morning, because today's topic will be Daniel chapter 5, where we see the fall of the Babylonian Empire. And so, you know, what he read there in Luke 21 provides great allusion to many of the things we'll bring up as we go through this, our thoughts this morning. So you might even want to keep your finger or a bookmark back to Luke 21, because you'll see how well it applies. So here in Daniel chapter 5, now we find Daniel at an approximate age of about 81 years old. This is about the year 542 BC. And if we follow the themes of this theme of judgment dealing with Daniel throughout the book, chapter 5 is a lesson in Yahweh's judgment upon human impiety. Yahweh's judgment upon human impiety. Now, a definition for impiety is the lack of reverence or respect for God or His sacred things. And so, as we go through this chapter, you will see it becomes very apparent that Yahweh pronounces judgment on Belshazzar for his lack of reverence and respect for Yahweh and even the instruments or implements of Yahweh's tabernacle. Turn over to Daniel 5, and let's look at verses 22 through 23, and you see a summary here of this point. Daniel 5, 22 through 23. "And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knowest all this, but hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before thee. And thou, and thy lords, and thy wives, and thy concubines, have drunk wine in them. And thou hast praised the gods of silver and gold, of brass, iron, wood, and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know. And the God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified." So, you know, yesterday we considered the events around the tree dream revealed to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. And, you know, in the conclusion of those events, we last saw Nebuchadnezzar as an humbled man. You know, he humbled himself before Yahweh, ruling over the Babylonian Empire. Look back at Daniel 4:37 and notice what, you know, Nebuchadnezzar was willing to state. He says, "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth, and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to abase. The mighty empire that Nebuchadnezzar had established before him lasted, though only as long as God required for the disciplining of his own people, Israel. The dynasty for Babylon was only to continue for a period of 70 years, as Jeremiah the prophet had predicted." Let's look over at Jeremiah 25, verse 12. Jeremiah 25, 12 states this, "And it shall come to pass, when 70 years are accomplished, that I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, saith Yahweh, for their iniquity, and the land of the Chaldeans, and I will make it a perpetual desolations." Now, Nebuchadnezzar, he reigned for the majority of these 70 years. But on his death, his son, a man named Evil Murdoch, came to the throne. And this man really didn't live that long. And pretty soon, we see that a conspiracy was placed against him. And another man came in to play named, I can't pronounce my names very well, but Nergalesar. We'll try that. He was the son-in-law to Nebuchadnezzar, and he seized the throne. Now, it was probably hoped that he would bring some order to the seething unrest that was now sweeping the nation of Babylon, but within 4 years, he too was dead, leaving his son, whose name is, we'll try, Labarosorkad, which was still a child at the time, to reign. But then, quickly, his life was taken as well. He was murdered, and this man, Nabonidus, a Babylonian lord who had been foremost in the plot, ascended the throne, and in order to make his position sure, he married the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. Now from her, he had a son whom he named Belshazzar, which means Bel, protect the king. So you can see how prevalent the pagan worship was still in this family. Bel, protect the king. But of course, this Bel, the god of the Babylonian people, certainly did not provide protection for this king in the end, as we shall see. So there's kind of a little bit of a family tree that I was able to determine. Now, you may find a few little differences, but I think that's a pretty good summary. Now, when Belshazzar was old enough, Nabonidus made him a joint ruler. So really, for a period of time, Nabonidus and Belshazzar, they reigned jointly as rulers or kings over Babylon. Now, think about, remember Daryl brought it to our attention here in Luke 21, where it talked about the aspect of watching. Those captives that were in Babylon definitely had to be watching. Do you not think that they were counting down the years that Jeremiah had predicted or prophesied? Those who were keenly watching the signs of the times had heard that this new young king had come to power in Persia, a small, relatively weak country just east of Babylon. This man's name was Cyrus. He had overthrown the Medes, or one of the rulers of the Medes, in the adjoining country of Media, and he had established his uncle in his place. And this man took on the title of Darius. Media had formerly been a powerful nation and had played an important part in conquering Assyria. But now it formed part of the joint empire, which we know as the Medo-Persian Empire. Nabonidus had a notion that trouble could be on the horizon, so he began preparing the defenses for Babylon. The elevation of Cyrus was also of the greatest significance to the Jewish captives, because they realized some 200 years prior, Isaiah the prophet had revealed that this would be the name of the king who should conquer Babylon. So turn back to Isaiah 45, verse 1. Isaiah 45, 1. Thus saith Yahweh to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden, to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings, to open before him the two-leaved gates, and the gates shall not be shut. How excited the Jews must have been when they learned that a king bearing such a name was now ruling in the east. How captives like Daniel must have pored over the prophecies of Isaiah and Jeremiah that they might better understand the significance of the current events that were happening around them. Remarkable things must have been heard about this man Cyrus. Men spoke about his wisdom and his moderation. His skill in war, as victory after victory was reported concerning him. And there was a great news about the affection and the respect that he commanded from his very soldiers. Rumors were heard that the new power of Medo-Persia might shortly launch an attack against Babylon. So the Jewish captives, who would have been students of God's word, realized that they were living in the epic of Babylon's impending fall. And that's really what Brother Daryl was bringing to our attention today, too. You know, we are living upon that point of time when we shall soon see the fall of great Babylon. They recognized that this was the time of restoration spoken of by Jeremiah the prophet. In many Jewish homes throughout Babylonia, these things must have been excitedly discussed, as brethren must have gathered around the words of the prophets. But it was difficult for them to place an exact sequence upon the events predicted. They could not understand the movements of Cyrus, although they may have tried to align them with their Bible in hand, or the Word of God in hand. It is said that he did not make a frontal attack upon Babylon, as would be expected. But instead, reports were that he had attacked cities and nations nearby. One time he would be reported to be here, and then another there, but not yet at Babylon, where he was anticipated. So I'm sure it may have been very frustrating to the Jewish captives as they discussed together the signs of the times. Much like we do, brethren. We watch these nations moving around Israel, but they don't seem to move like maybe we would want them to move, or as fast as they would. But all are in, well, we have to realize, all is in hand of Yahweh. These brethren would have liked to have forcibly compelled Cyrus to march on Babylon, as was predicted. But news at last came to the kings that the kings of the east, that is, these men named Darius and Cyrus, were on their march towards Babylon. The Jews would have settled back to await the inevitable end. So Nabonidus departed Babylon to organize an army to attack Cyrus upon another front, which would have left Belshazzar in complete control of the city of Babylon and awaiting his father's return. Of course, then this sets this historical stage for understanding the events which are recorded in the fifth chapter of Daniel. You know, it seems as though if you go from chapter to chapter through the book of Daniel, it's like this chapter falls chronologically behind chapter 4 when Nebuchadnezzar was still in power over Babylon. But really, we have to realize that chapters 7 and 8 occur during the first and third years of Belshazzar's reign. So not all the books in the book of Daniel are in chronological order. But this book, or this chapter 5, is chronological in the sense that many years have transpired between Nebuchadnezzar's reign and when Belshazzar ruled as king of Babylon. It is believed that Belshazzar was a young man in his teens, and most likely power and affluence had spoiled him, resulting in a conceited, arrogant, and a pompous man. From the scriptural account, we can see that he did not display any fear of this approaching enemy. Historical writers indicate that the city of Babylon was believed to be secure with its towering walls that Nebuchadnezzar had built during his reign. You go on back to Jeremiah 51, you know, there's some indications to that there as well about the towering walls or the security that this city would have afforded. Let's see. In Jeremiah 51, verses 11 through 13, there it says, "Make the arrows bright, gather the shields. Yahweh has raised up the spirit of the kings of the Medes, for his plan is against Babylon to destroy it, because it is the vengeance of Yahweh, the vengeance for his temple. Set up the standard on the walls of Babylon, make the guard strong, set up the watchmen, prepare the ambushes, for Yahweh has both devised and done what he spoke against the inhabitants of Babylon. O you who dwell by many waters, abundant in treasures, your end has come, the measure of your covetousness." So no matter how many men were placed upon the walls of Babylon, Yahweh's will would be done. But of course, it was Belshazzar's interest to pursue his fleshly desires and participate in an annual religious festivity, which was celebrated in the most depraved manner, where Belshazzar set himself out to excel in the pleasures of the moment. And we see back in Daniel chapter 5, verses 1 through 3, that he invited all the lords, the princes, the wives, the concubines, to his palace that they might attend a great feast which he had prepared. And we can see in verses 2 and 4 that wine was supplied without measure. The king drank to excess, and he became completely intoxicated. The word tasted there in verse 2 does not denote merely to sip the wine, but it actually means to partake without moderation, to quaff it immoderately. So as the king became drunk, he became more reckless and unrestrained in his conduct. Once intoxicated, the king devised a further act of blasphemous wickedness. He called for the gold and silver vessels taken by Nebuchadnezzar from the temple at Jerusalem 70 years before. So here now he's going to take the implements of the temple and use them in his revelry. Let's stop for a minute in this line of events and consider how the words of the prophets foretold of these exact events which would transpire in Babylon. You know, we just looked at Jeremiah, and we see how he had predicted the overthrow of Babylon. Well, interesting enough, not only had he predicted this overthrow in Babylon, he had sent a messenger to Babylon to read this prediction to them. So if you go on back to Jeremiah 51, let's read some more verses there. We'll read verses 60 through 64. So Jeremiah wrote in the book all the evil that should come upon Babylon, even all these words that are written against Babylon. And Jeremiah said to Sarariah, "When thou comest to Babylon and shalt see, and shalt read all these words, then thou shalt say, O Yahweh, thou hast spoken against this place to cut it off, that none shall remain in it, neither man nor beast, but it shall be desolate forever. And it shall be when thou hast made an end of reading this book, that thou shalt bind a stone to it and cast it into the midst of the Euphrates. And thou shalt say, Thus shall Babylon sink, and shall not rise from the evil that I will bring upon her, and they shall be weary. Thus far are the words of Jeremiah." So we have to wonder, did Belshazzar ever hear about this? Or was Belshazzar even in the presence of this very reading that occurred in the streets of Babylon? Well, scriptures do testify that Belshazzar chose to deliberately ignore the facts relating to the pride of his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar. So let's go back to chapter 5 and read verses 18. Daniel 5, 18. We read, O thou king, the most high God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he slew. Whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he set up. And whom he would, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up, and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. Now I'll go down to verse 22. And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this, but hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before thee, and thou and thy lords and thy wives, thy concubines, have drunk wine. So we see here, Daniel brings to his attention, you knew about this. It wasn't kept secret from you what was told to your father. You knew about it. And I think we've seen plenty of scriptural evidence regarding this aspect of how he had become drunk with these false doctrines, this intoxicating wine. Brother Darrell brought them to our attention this morning. You can go to Revelation 18. You can go back to Jeremiah 51, verse 7, and you can see, we read that yesterday, about how Babylon had been a golden cup in Yahweh's hand and made the earth drunken. So it was during this drunken feast that a hand appeared writing upon the wall of the king's palace, It drew the attention of the entire party and caused the countenance of Belshazzar to quickly change from one of laughter, frivolity, pride, to that of fear and concern. Verse 6 says, his thoughts troubled him so that the joints of his loins were loosed and his knees smote one against another. Consider how this was already foretold. Back in Isaiah 45, verse 1, we see this read, this prophecy. Thus saith Yahweh to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden to subdue nations before him, I will loose the loins of kings to open before him the two-leaved gates, and the gates shall not be shut. So it was foretold that Cyrus would do this very thing that was happening to Belshazzar. Isaiah 21, another example. Isaiah 21, verses 1 through 9. The burden of the desert or the sea, as whirlwinds in the south pass through, so it come from the desert, from a terrible land. A grievous vision is declared unto me, the treacherous dealer dealeth treacherously, and the spoiler spoileth. Go up, O Elam, besiege, O Media, all the sighing thereof I have made to cease. Therefore are my loins filled with pain. Pangs have taken upon me as the pangs of a woman that travaileth. I bowed down at the hearing of it. I was dismayed at the seeing of it. My heart panted, fearfulness affrighted me. The night of my pleasure hath he turned into fear unto me. The night of my pleasure hath he turned into fear unto me. Prepare the table. Watch in the watchtower. Eat, drink, arise, ye princes, and anoint the shield. For hath the Lord said unto me, go, set a watchman, let him declare what he seeth. And he saw a chariot with a couple of horsemen, a chariot of asses, and a chariot of camels. And he hearkened diligently with much heed. And he cried, a lion, my Lord, I stand continually upon the watchtower in the daytime, and I'm set in the ward the whole night. And behold, here cometh a chariot of men with a couple of horsemen. And he answered and said, Babylon is fallen. And all the graven images of her gods he hath broken unto the ground. So brethren, you know, those who were captives in Babylon knew what was to come about to that city. They should have been prepared. They were ready for it. But not Belshazzar. Without taking his eyes off the hand, he called for the wise men of Babylon. Hastily they gathered at the palace, trying to understand the writing which appeared upon the wall. In verse 7 of Daniel 5, he declared, Whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. So the successful contestant was promised that he would be robed in a scarlet robe, that of royalty, I guess you might say, decorated with a chain of gold about his neck as a symbol of his royal rank and authority, and he would share the third highest dignity in the kingdom jointly with Nabonidus and Belshazzar. So Nabonidus, I can't say his name very well, was but in the first, Belshazzar in the second position, and whoever interpreted this writing would be made third in control. You know, it is kind of significant that these rewards that were promised are somewhat the same type of promises that's given to the faithful of Yahweh. It's really believed that this scarlet robe was really a purple robe. Purple is the color of royalty and of God manifestation, as we know. And in the authorized version, the word scarlet robe is rendered that it was really purple. Now, if it were a scarlet vesture, it would be an appropriate color for the kings of Babylon. But in the case of a promised vesture for the man of God, purple would have been, of course, the most appropriate color. And of course, we know gold is that which symbolized tried faith. And being placed third in the place of the royal dignity of the future kingdom of God, we know that's something to be shared by the saints in conjunction with the Father and Son of the kingdom to come, yet to be established. We know from Revelation 3:21, it says, "To him that overcometh will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and am set down with my Father in his throne." So we know from the account that Daniel was summoned by Belshazzar to interpret this writing. And upon the arrival, the rewards for the interpretation were noted. But such offers of reward in a Babylonian doomed destruction, a Babylon which was doomed for destruction, had no appeal for Daniel. Note what he says in verse 17. "Let thy gifts be to thyself, give thy rewards to another." Let thy gifts be to thyself and give thy rewards to another. You know, we remember that Daniel previously had accepted from Nebuchadnezzar, you know, his prestige and honor. But it might have been because Nebuchadnezzar actually showed a little bit of a spirit of humility towards Yahweh. You know, especially after the image dream was interpreted, and later on after he had been, we see the tree dream and his restoration from being brought up from the bases of men, or beasts of the field, I mean. You know, Nebuchadnezzar did honor the God of Israel on a few occasions, but we see that Belshazzar only blasphemed him, and he refused to humble himself. Think about this as well. The rejection of these gifts from Belshazzar to Daniel makes us think about the gifts that were extended by the kings of Sodom to Abram. Go back to Genesis 14, verse 22. Genesis 14, verse 22. "And Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have lifted up my hand unto Yahweh, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take from a thread even to a shoe latchet, and that I will not take anything that is thine, lest thou should say, I have made Abram rich." And in 3 John chapter 1, verses 5 through 7, we have a similar attitude. "Beloved, thou doest faithfully whatsoever thou doest to the brethren and to strangers, which have borne witness of thy charity before the ecclesia, whom if thou bring forward on their journey after a goodly sort, thou shalt do well, because for his name's sake they went forth, taking nothing of the Gentiles." And it also seems to make me think about the trouble. Remember the trouble that came upon the house of Israel because of the man Achan. You know, when he took and stole the Babylonian garment, the pieces of silver, and the wedge of gold. You know, those things, brethren, there's nothing that the Babylonian system can offer us as a reward that can provide us anything of value. So before Daniel provided the interpretation of the writing on the wall, he continued his rebuke of Belshazzar by bringing into remembrance the hand of Yahweh in the life of his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel was very direct and forthright with Belshazzar. What faith it must have taken for Daniel to criticize this king. Note what he says in verse 22. "O Belshazzar, thou hast not humbled thy heart, though thou knewest all this." How humiliated the king must have felt in front of his guests for this man to be saying such a thing to him. But he dared not oppose the prophet, for he knew he would not receive the help from anybody else within his realm. So Daniel continued in his rebuke in verse 23. "But hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven, and have brought the vessels of this house before thee." And if you keep going on down, in verse 24, it says, "Then was the part of the hand sent from him, and this writing was written. And this is the writing which was written, Many, many, Tekel, Upharsin." The words basically mean numbered, numbered, weighed, divided. And it's interesting that the first words, you know, many, many, were pronounced or said twice, which basically provide us the aspect of certainty or completeness. Compare that with what we know in Genesis 41:32. In Genesis 41:32, it says, "And for the dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice, it is because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass." So it's basically, it's a point of emphasis by Yahweh. It will definitely occur. So then Daniel supplied the interpretation to the king. "Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tikal, you are weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians." Now here we notice that Daniel used the word perez in his explanation because it is a participle of this same verb from whence the word eupharsin is derived. Eupharsin signifies, "and they divided it." But when Daniel used the related word perez, he gave a greater meaning to the word, or to this writing on the wall. The Persians were known to the Chaldeans as a people called the Paros, P-A-R-O-S. So there was really a play on the words, enabling him not only to say that the kingdom would be divided, but this kingdom would be given to the hand of the Persians. So in verses 29 through 31, we see then this. "Then commanded Belshazzar, they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. In that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. And Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old." So this simple statement sums up the drama of the mighty city's downfall. We know from historical writers that the overthrow of Babylon is really to be attributed to the man Cyrus, although the final verses here notes that Darius came to rule immediately after Babylon's demise. A historian of ancient times is quoted as stating this, and you can read his name there, I don't want to try to pronounce it. He says, "But Cyrus, when he heard that there was to be such a feast in Babylon, in which all the Babylonians would feast and revel through the whole night, on that night, as soon as it began to grow dark, taking many men, opened the dams into the river and allowed them to again flood the country, so that he could enter Babylon beneath its walls in the channel of the river." He quotes the address to Cyrus of his army as being this: "Now, men, let us go up against them. Many of them are asleep, many of them are intoxicated, and all of them are unfit for battle." Another historian states, "It was a day of festivity among them, and whilst the citizens were engaged in dance and merriment, Babylon was, for the first time, thus taken." Now, back in Isaiah, it was predicted that the gates of brass would no longer provide a defense for the city, and that the bars of iron would be cut asunder. That's found in Isaiah 45, verse 2. Herodotus, the historian, states that these brazen gates were situated along the banks of the river, but at the time of the attack, some of them had been left open. And it's believed that probably someone within the city had come to terms with the Persians and had helped them with this event. Belshazzar was not preserved from the violence of the moment, but on that very night in which he had given himself with his family over to blasphemous pleasure at the expense of the holy things of God, he was slain. And as Nabonidus, his father, was absent from the city, then Daniel, who would then have just been elevated to third ruler in that city, was brought prominently before the notice of Darius and Cyrus, the kings of the east. For a time, however, Cyrus was busy elsewhere establishing his power so that Darius the Mede then took over authority of the kingdom. You know, brethren, we would be remiss if we did not consider for a moment this man, Cyrus, and the spiritual lessons that Yahweh has placed within the pages of prophecy before we finish our thoughts on this chapter. Cyrus was named by Yahweh about 160 years before the capture of Babylon. His name, his office, his mission are all representative. The name given in the Hebrew is the word Koresh, which is interpreted by some as the word sun, like the sun in the sky. On the ground that the Greek writers affirm that the name in Persian, in the Persian language, signified the sun. But Koresh in the Hebrew does not signify the sun. It is rather a compounded word, a proper name. Two words, Kaf or C-A-F or C-A-P-H, which means like, and Yorash, which means to seize or to take possession of, to occupy, mostly by force. That is, it signifies one who takes its possession of his inheritance by conquest. So Yahweh then took the letter Kaf and, condensing the three syllables into two, named him Koresh, which signifies like the air, H-E-I-R. This definition of Cyrus's Hebrew name accords with the facts of history. Yahweh has predetermined that he should inherit the Babylonian Empire, which included the Holy Land, and that he should take possession of it by conquest. He therefore made this Yorash a part of his name. We also understand that he intended Cyrus's career to be typical of his own son's career, whom he hath constituted as heir of all things, and who is able to acquire a possession of his inheritance by conquest. Turn over to Isaiah 13. Let's look at verses 1 through 5. Isaiah 13, 1. The burden of Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amoz did see. Lift up, lift ye up a banner upon the high mountain, exalt the voice unto them, shake the hand, that they may go into the gates of the nobles. I have commanded my sanctified ones, I have called my mighty ones for mine anger, even them that rejoice in my highness. The noise of a multitude in the mountains, like as of a great people, a tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of nations gathered together. Yahweh of hosts mustereth the host of the battle. They come from a far country, from the end of heaven, even Yahweh in the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. Before Cyrus and Darius, with their sanctified ones, as we see portrayed here in Isaiah, could take possession of Babylon, this great river Euphrates, which flowed into and through the city, had to be dried up. Let me say that again. Before Cyrus and Darius, along with their sanctified ones, as we see in chapter 13 of Isaiah, before they could take possession of Babylon, the great Euphrates, which flowed into and through the city, had to be dried up. Compare this to the other scriptures, brethren. Isaiah 44, verse 27. That saith to the deep, be dry, and I will dry up thy rivers, that saith the Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid. And if you go on to chapter 45, we've read those already, talking about Cyrus is anointed and loosing the loins of the kings and opening the levied gates. Go to Jeremiah 50, verse 35. Jeremiah 50, verse 35. A sword is upon the Chaldeans, saith Yahweh, and upon the inhabitants of Babylon, and upon her princes, and upon her wise men. Verse 38. a drought is upon her waters, and they shall be dried up. For it is the land of graven images, and they are mad upon their idols." Turn over to chapter 51. Look at verse 35. "The violence done to me and to my flesh be upon Babylon, shall the inhabitant of Zion say, and my blood upon the inhabitants of Chaldea shall Jerusalem say." Verse 36, "Therefore saith the Lord," or Yahweh, "Behold, I will plead thy cause and take vengeance for thee, and I will dry up her sea and make her springs dry." This, brethren, was literally accomplished by Cyrus, who turned the Euphrates from its course and left the channel of the river dry, allowing his troops to march up the dried way into the night, into the heart of Babylon, and coming upon the king's nobles as a thief in the night, put them without discrimination or mercy to the sword. Cyrus and the sanctified ones, the Medes and the Persians, were typical of Christ and his kings in the way prepared through the drying up of the great river Euphrates, as is prophesied to us in Revelation chapter 16. Revelation 16:12 says, "And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared." The political river Euphrates has been partially dried up with the antitypical Cyrus, so that the antitypical Cyrus might attack Babylon the Great. The way, or the route, is the Middle East, and the Promised Land in particular. Christ will first reveal his power in Jerusalem, and from that center will move out against Great Babylon, as we're told in Revelation 16:19. The political river Euphrates, that being the Turkish Empire, was dried up from the land of promise in 1917, as we mentioned yesterday, when the British, under General Allenby, drove the Turks from the land. Since then, with the return of the Jewish exiles and the revival of Israel, that way is in a course of preparation. We haven't seen it yet, brethren, but it's being prepared. The term kings of the east is from the Greek word Anatole Helios, which means kings who are out of a sun's rising. The symbol of a son of righteousness, as seen in Malachi 4:2, is applied to the Lord Jesus Christ. The sun is the great illuminator of the earth, and is therefore an apt symbol for the Lord, or Christ, who will enlighten mankind with his glory and his Father's glory. The warmth of the sun after winter causes growth to spring forth from the earth, a symbol of the resurrection. But as springtime causes both flowers and weeds to appear, so also will the resurrection. The judgment will discriminate between such, to the former to reveal their full glory, and the latter their destruction. The kings who are out of the sun's rising, therefore, will be those who will be granted immortality at the resurrection and will live and reign with Christ for that thousand-year period, as were promised in Revelation 20, verse 4. Christ and the redeemed will comprise the antitype of Cyrus and his associates who marched to the destruction of Babylon in the days of Belshazzar. This way towards world domination by Christ and the saints continues to be prepared by Yahweh in the outworking of his plan as Israel and the nations round about her continue in their development. A plan that will culminate in the Battle of Armageddon, and brethren, will lead to the eventual fall of Babylon and the outset of the restored kingdom to Israel. So, we can see then how this chapter fits real well with the summary that was said, a judgment on human impiety. Judgment upon those that have a lack of reverence towards God or his sacred things. Especially this Babylonian system, whose lack of reverence of God's word has brought in false doctrines, rituals, pagan rituals, etc. This Babylonian system, who basically was part of the crucifixion of God's very own son. How more sacred of a thing could you have than that? Think about Yahweh's children through the ages, the persecutions that they have had to face. Think about His chosen people, Israel, the anti-Semitism which continues to be exhibited and has been throughout history. And specifically, His holy land, the land of promise which He has given. These were all reverenced things that are sacred to Him that have not been regarded. So in conclusion, what I'd like to do is just read Revelation 14, 6 through 13. Then I saw another angel flying in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation, tribe, tongue, and people, saying with a loud voice, "Fear God and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment has come, and worship Him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water." And another angel followed, saying, "Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she has made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication." Then a third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast and has his image and receives his mark on his forehead or on his hand, he himself shall also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night who worship the beast and his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus." Then I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, "Write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, and their works follow them."